As you can see, the screen is a bit jittery, so not only the galactic center is closer to Germany, but also some computers are running at a different frequency in Germany. But anyway, so this is the title, and I hope I don't have to tell you why I changed the title a bit to say AGN number one, because I think Sanjay Star is AGN number one. For us. And these are the people that are associated with this project, especially I should point out Jorge Cuadra, who is a PhD student working with me. So this is the outline of the talk. Most of the time I will be concentrating on this part on the top, so testing the two star formation models that we have. N-body simulations, basically, of their evolution. Then I want to slip two quick ideas and also mention this poster by Jorge Cuadra on the our simulations of Sanjay Star feeding. So you've all seen this these pictures. And because you would like to understand the formation of the young massive stars you see there. But I should mention that there are two levels to this mystery. As we already heard, that the first level is the outer, so to say, helium-1 stars, which are on the distances of 0.1 to 0.2 per sec. And it's difficult enough to understand star formation there. But then there is even a larger problem, a factor of 10 or so closer in. So I'm just going to be concentrating on this part, on this mystery and in this talk. So how do we understand the, how do we distinguish between the two different theories? Well, one approach is to try to form these things from first principles, right? And this is from a paper by Kim et al. And we'll hear more about work like this later today. So even though the stellar content or stellar mass, initial mass of this cluster should be very large, and so it's a bit finely tuned, in my opinion, the model does appear to be working. Also, you can do analytical estimates or numerical simulations, and you find that you can also form stars as long as the disk is massive enough. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a slightly different approach. So I'm going to start sort of astropaleontology, if you want, by looking at the remains of the system. I will try to understand what it means. And if you have a PhD in this wonderful subject, you would, of course, be able to tell, you know, which of the guys is there, right? So what are the bones that we have? Well, these are basically these two disks. And we've heard from Frank today that we have much more data now. But it's basically this. And notice some of the important numbers on the top there, the chi-squared for these two disks. And as Frank said, these disks appear to be a bit better defined and geometrically thinner than the counterclockwise system, this one. Also, the inclinations between the two disks is an important issue. And this is how it looks like schematically on the plane of the sky here. And this is the, just for you, just for reference, orientation of a galactic plane. So you see that it forms a very large angle with respect to these two disks. So the method that I'm going to be using is just to study the orbital precession in the axisymmetric potential. So first of all, I'm going to say, well, we know there are two disks, two stellar disks there. I don't know why, how exactly you form it, but I'm just going to start with this assumption that we had two roughly equal disks. And then what is known is that if you have an orbit in a potential of the central object, the supermassive black hole, and some sort of a disk, then you have precession around this z axis here, so that if you call this angle phi, for example, then this angle is changing with time. The inclination of this orbit with respect to the disk does not change as long as this object is not massive enough to start changing the orbit of the orbits of the particles in the disk itself. But this angle is changing, so that the particle will precess. And then, of course, particles on different orbits at different radii precess at different rates. So if you start with something which was planar, so if I start with a collection of orbits all lying in this plane, they will precess at different rates. And in a while, you will see that this is not a good disk anymore, right? And so this, we can compare that with the chi-squared for with disks that we have in the galactic center, and then reject some of the models. Well, this is the axis of symmetry. I mean, well, what I'm going to be doing is the n-body simulations. So there, I mean, I'm not assuming any axis of symmetry. I mean, I'm just going to tell you in a minute how exactly I set it up. Okay. Yes. Right. Right. Yeah.
And do your axis symmetric potential just mean that you have a quadrupole homo that you're adding to the distribution of mass in the background, right?
You're right, yeah. Why is it external? Sorry,
is it one disk perturbing the other, or there's an external potential that has...
No, there is no external potential. No, I'm just going to concentrate on the interaction of these two disks that you have two there. Okay. The what? Right. Yes. Okay. Good. So this is just an example of an n-body simulation here. So I have a massless disk, so with negligible mass, and this ring has a mass of I think of a percent of the black hole mass, and it is inclined at 45 degrees with respect to this disk. Okay, so let me just show you how it's going. Yeah. Look like in a while. So, of course, the yellow ring evolves by n-body interactions, so it spreads. But this is expected. What you should be looking at is just evolution of the red points, right? So that what happens is the outer ring of the disk is being warped very slowly, while the inner rings are being warped very quickly, and so. Very quickly you get complete mess, right? Well, this depends on the mass of this ring, and I'm going to show you some equations that will tell you about that, okay, in a second. So this come back. Okay, yeah, so you can do analytical calculations. This is an approximate equation for the rate of precession in a field of circular orbit in a field of an infinitely thin ring. Okay, so this is this precession frequency, and what you can do is you can say, well, in after time t, I'm going to process by this amount, delta phi, and roughly speaking, it goes as the ratio of the mass of the ring to the black hole mass, and you know, some geometrical factors, the cosine of the angle of the inclination angle between these two things, and then some this radial dependence there. But these things are somewhat smaller than what than one, and so roughly speaking, you have something like this. So it goes as the ratio, the mass ratio of a ring to a black hole mass, and times the number of orbital revolutions that you have during this time. And for the galactic center, this number is a few order of 1,000. So really, you become to be sensitive to this warping, then the this ratio is about 10 to minus 3 or so. Okay, so you can probe regimes, I mean, you can probe masses of the order of few times 10 to 3 to 10 to 4 solar masses or so. What I'm going to do now is do a more precise comparison with the data. And for this, I assume, first of all, so I have initially these two systems. I have the clockwise disk, and which I populate with stars between 2 and 5 arc seconds. Then I have the counterclockwise system, which I call ring. And I tested two cases, populated in 5 and 7 arc seconds and 4 and 5 arc seconds. The results are really not very different, so between those two cases. Then I set the inclination angle between the two planes at the observed value of 113 degrees. First I'm going to be testing the accretion disk case, in which case you start with basically circular orbits, circular Keplerian orbits, because initially the disk is very thin and the gas is on exactly Keplerian orbits, so you expect the stars to be formed with these velocities. And these are the observed locations of the, so this is clockwise system and this is counterclockwise system. And I start with stars oriented exactly like this. Do I have to explain this system of coordinates actually, or it's just the angular momentum of the rings. If you see something which is rotating, let's say this is the angular momentum, you're looking from here, it's rotating like this, it's going to be this line of sight, right? So this is going to be clockwise and this is counterclockwise. So, and then I run the in-body simulations for 3 million years, which I think is the lower limit for the age of these stars. And I just compute the chi-squared. The other step I do is I take the average errors for the position for the stellar velocities measured in actual observations, and just look at the chi-squared. So here I have chi-squared of the, I believe this is the disk, and this is the ring. So this is for this system, and the second number is for this. And if you increase the mass in the disk and the mass in the ring, here I increase it by a factor of 2 for the ring and by a factor of 4 for the disk, you see that this warping is stronger and the particles start to migrate from the initial position, like also spread around because of the difference in radii, right? So I go to get higher disk mass. This is the previous two had a low chi-squared consistent with the data. This has chi-squared slightly larger than the data. Let me just check if I'm not confusing which one. Yeah, so the first should be the ring. So this is the ring and this is the disk. So for the disk in the actual data, you have chi-squared of 2.5. So this is 50% larger, so right? And this is, as you can see, is a horrible fit. The warping is too strong, and actually, some of the stars that are now red with now marked with the green originally started in this disk and migrated there. Okay, so this you can definitely reject, right? And this has a mass of about both the disk and the ring of 3.5 times 10 to 4 solar masses. So this we can reject. So then what I can do is I can try to introduce some quality factor, I call it, and extrapolate between a grid of models and the mass ring, mass of the ring and mass of the disk. And roughly speaking, your anything which is light is ruled out. So somewhere from here is the to the top, and to the right is area where you should reject the models. So this is roughly speaking the maximum mass you could have for the clockwise system and for the counterclockwise system. Now you can play the same game with the for the cluster model, and here is a distribution of eccentricities and inclination angles calculated by Levin et al. And this is initial conditions which you get for eccentric in spiral. This is circular in spiral for the cluster, and this is eccentric in spiral. So here you get a great range in eccentricities and also in the inclination angles. This is only up to 20 degrees, and this is 180, right? So they create initial conditions that are quite similar, I think, to the Levin et al. Result for circular in spiral, and did the same exercise. And what happens here is that because of the at the same radius now, you have orbits that have different eccentricities, way process at different rates. So you mix up the disk much faster, and therefore the maximum mass of the disk and the ring from which you could start it, could have started, is actually lower. So this is just for you to notice. Sorry? Yeah? Well, I do exactly what I told you. I just start, in this case, with orbits that are not circular but eccentric, with the distribution of inclinations. Yes. So now you can also play this game. You can start with the disks as thick as observed, and wait for time which is much smaller than 3 million years. So let's say 10 to 6 million years. And see how much the disk would be warped. This gives you the maximum mass of the disk, so to say, now. Okay? And if you play this game, you find a slightly smaller numbers. But, so like 6 times 10 to 3 solar masses for the clockwise system. And this is interesting because then you can say, well, you know what the observed number count for the high mass stars gives you mass of several thousand solar masses, and so I can subtract it from that total mass and get a limit on the mass of the low mass stars, total mass of the low mass stars, and this comes out to be also just a few thousand solar masses. So it seems that whatever process operated there, you should have formed the mass of the low mass stars should be just comparable, but not much greater than the mass of the high mass stars. Okay, so that should be very top heavy IMF. And now, if you compare it with the models, actually it is consistent with the infalling cluster idea. And this is from a paper by Gurkam and Rezio, and also consistent with the upper limits there. If you do it with the disk, it's
actual observation of high mass stars.
Right. Yeah.
What
a few thousand solar masses. So it seems that in the disk you could also have a top-heavy IMF because of extreme high densities and completely different star formation conditions and from a normal star formation. Okay, I'm going to be skipping these two quick points which I wanted to make and just show you the movie which Jorge unfortunately will not be able to show on our simulations of the accretion of stellar winds. So the black dots are with stars, and some of them are, and the jittery here is because of the number of a finite number of pixels that they're using. But this one, for example, is a Wolf-Rayet star, so it sends out hot winds which do not cool. That's why there is no yellow stuff forming around it. The yellow stuff is the dense gas. This one is a slow wind star, an LBV candidate, and it creates winds with only 300 kilometers per second. And at the high pressure environment in the galactic center, you can easily show that it's going to cool, okay, and form a disk in this case because we populated, we made the two stellar disks in this case. So, well, I'm not going to run this, but just say that this is the accretion rate, and this is the hot gas in the red, and the cool gas, this cold clumps there, and you can see that it's highly variable on time scales of hundreds, maybe a few tens years or so. It's just a different simulation, but with different initial conditions, and results are completely different. So this is what tells you that we need better stellar orbits. We do not have final results. We have a method to model the accretion. So this is my conclusions. So. You're right, it would completely destroy the disk there. So in fact, this is the reason why we run the simulations only for a few thousand years, because you figure that every few thousand years there should be a supernova. Also, we do not include any infalling cool gas, such as a mini spiral or something like that. It's going to be much more complicated in reality, sure, but no, I don't think so. It would probably change the orientation of the disk. I don't think it's wind from a single star. Probably winds from many different stars in that cluster, and some of them can be also slow and also cool. So. Well, we put 10 to minus 3 solar masses per year in total for the cluster. This is a function of how many LBV stars versus Wolf-Rayet stars you have, and in here we had 8 versus 12. And out of that, probably a bit more than a half gets settled into this disk. So. Well, let me show you. Minus 1.5 may also. Uh, just a sec. This is too many questions at once. So the other question was about. See here. This is a recent observation by Palmer et al. And so everybody was modeling these beams, the 1,000 km/s beams. But it has also been discovered that there are also these stars with outflow velocities of only 200 km/s or so. So what we've put in is 300 km/s. Yeah. Well, we only heat up to temperatures of 10 to 6 K versus 10 to 7 K. And because of the cooling function also, it goes as a very steep function of wind velocity, like wind to power, I mean, the velocity to power 5.4. So, you can easily show that this is the cooling time for this wind should be 15 years or something like that.
So your potential mass power
Well, sorry, I haven't yet seen the poster, and I'm not yet convinced that it is a good cluster, because for IRIS 13, for example, Reinhardt, Genzel was not convinced seemingly that this is a good cluster. The velocity dispersion that you should have to keep the stars together is extremely small, because you have about 1,000 revolutions or so. So is it just maybe just statistics that?
So, the point is that already there's much more
right. You have to convince me that this is a good cluster indeed still first.
Okay, let me ask one last question. So if I understand the last part of your talk, you're forming stars from wind material.
Well,
you're forming a disk out of the wind material. Are you then going to form stars out of that disk?
Not really, because the rate at which you deposit the material in this disk is few times 10 to minus 4 solar masses per year. And as Heine mentioned, that every few thousand years you have the supernova explosions which disrupt the disk and so on. So I don't imagine that you could have stored more than several solar masses in this disk. And also, as I said, really, whether you form this disk or not depends on the stellar orbits that you assume. And observations of the ionized gas do not really show such a disk in linear arc second. So I'm inclined more to think that we need better orbits, to make a better model at this point.
Okay, let's stop here. Thank Sergey again.